This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is a special bonus episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits. What does it take to be a leader? And what do all the Brexit years tell us about doing the top job? Well, few know better than Tim Shipman and the third instalment of his history of the Brexit years. No Way Out is out this week. And I sat down with him for a special chat to discuss those years from 2017 to 2019, Theresa May's desperate struggle to get anything to happen. And what does that tell us about leadership? And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio for free on your DAB radio, your smart speaker, or you can download the Times Radio app. It's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. So, Tim Shipman, your new book, No Way Out, chronicles the Brexit years from 2017 to 2019. So the third part, it began with All Out War, which told us how Brexit happened. Fallout covered Theresa May becoming Prime Minister and then losing her majority. We pick up then in 2017 after that election. Did you think you'd still be writing about all of this Brexit business 8 years on since we voted to leave? And do you wish you hadn't?
My wife wishes I hadn't. I mean, I figured this was a sort of long haul, but when I set out to write the third book, I figured I'd be filing it in a couple of years, and instead it's been nearer seven because the ending kept retreating ever further into the distance. The Tory party kept doing fun and games. Parliament kept not quite making its mind up. And in the end, so much happened. I wrote so much that we've had to divide it into two books.
So it's now
we're calling it a quartet. I think some people would call it a tetralogy or something.
I'm sure
like
they
that.
Would. So this is the period from the 2017 election, essentially, Theresa May loses a majority until Theresa May goes. And loads happen there. I mean, the book is incredibly thick. It's packed with shenanigans, I think it's fair to say. But ultimately, not a lot happens in the grand scheme of things. Theresa May spends the best part of 2 years trying to get a whole load of stuff through, none of which works, and that's why she has to pack in. And you put forward your sort of theory of power, and you say that there are sort of three things you need to be a successful leader, and if you lack them, you're going to struggle. So take us through the Shipman theory of power.
Well, look, I mean, this whole period is a sort of exercise in how to solve a political problem, both for Theresa May and for the people who followed her. And basically, the more I've looked at all this and I'm trying to find a theme for the third book and I'm thinking about it, it's really about how you get power, what you do with it, how you exercise it, and is it effective? And what I've tried to do in this book, because there's strong feelings on both sides of this, is to try and judge people in their own terms. Did they achieve what they were trying to achieve? And ultimately, Theresa May didn't. I'd slightly dispute that nothing happened. I think this period is probably the bit that is most formative for the Brexit settlement that we've got now. Yes, book four will be all about Boris Johnson. That's tremendously exciting, and how he eventually drives it all through. But the actual settlement he signed, certainly the initial sort of exit deal was 95% what Theresa May did. So what happened in these years was really important. She didn't really know where she was going. She didn't really know how she was going to get there. And she didn't then have the ability to take the country with her because she herself was discovering. So I think it's those three things. To be successful, you've got to know where you're going. You've got to then have a plan to try and do that. And then you've got to have the ability to drive it through. And I think if you're lacking one of those, you can just about survive as a prime minister. If you lack two, you've got problems. And in Theresa May's case, arguably, she was late to decide where she was going. She didn't really devise a way of taking anyone with her. And in fact, at key points in this, she was quite secretive and tried to sort of change her mind and do things without really even telling her cabinet what she was up to. And then, you know, you saw a lot of fatal flaws in her ability to, A, persuade MPs, B, persuade the public what she was about, and C, to persuade, you know, people in Brussels that it was the right way to go. And the story of this book really is three massive negotiations, arguably four. Maybe the first was with herself. But the three big ones really are, you know, with her cabinet, which culminates in that famous meeting at Chequers where they finally decide what it is that they're going to go and ask for. Then a huge sort of debate throughout the rest of 2018, the second half of 2018, which is the negotiation with Brussels. Can she get the deal she wants? It's not quite what she wants. And then probably the most interesting part of the book, I think, is the sort of battles with Parliament, where, you know, it becomes 4D chess between Theresa May, the people in Brussels, and the multiple groups in Parliament who all have a view of their own. That great negotiation with Parliament ends in deadlock. And that's what, you know, in the end, I conclude that, you know, she made Boris Johnson not only inevitable, but kind of necessary to come in and break the deadlock.
You talk early on about how the seeds of her problems were sown even before she became Prime Minister, the manner in which she became Prime Minister, that she didn't have to come up with her own idea. She didn't win a battle because of what happened with Angela Leadsom pulling out. So she, what ultimately held her back right the way through then was that she didn't know what she wanted to do and she didn't have a mandate for it, even if she did.
No, and not having that leadership election properly in 2016, because first Michael Gove dispatched Boris Johnson, and then Andrea Leadsom kind of dispatched herself. And Theresa May then didn't have to think hard about what it was that she was going to do and then justify that and fight, you know, in a leadership election with someone who was a Brexiteer and was more Eurosceptic than she was, with a membership that was inherently more sympathetic to whoever it was she would have been up against. And she'd have had to kind of make the argument and stress test it and work out what worked and what didn't in her own head. So that was not beneficial for her. It wasn't beneficial for the Conservative Party. It certainly wasn't beneficial for the country.
And there was also then the problem that because she hadn't really thought about it, both sides, instead of her then being able to reach out to both sides became suspicious of her. Remainers thought she was too Brexity. Brexiteers thought she was too Remainery. There was a sort of suspicion.
Yeah, no, quite. And because she's not a very good sort of advocate for herself, she was unable really to explain when she was coming from. I mean, I've interviewed, you know, 260-odd people for this book. And almost to a man or woman, the people who found themselves in a room with her, be it MPs, her ministers, people in Brussels, her own aides, half the time they had no idea what she was thinking about this stuff. She was like a sort of black hole absorbing comments and information from other people and arguments and not reflecting much back. And as a result of that, you know, she had a systemic problem that she wasn't a Brexiteer. So, you know, she made mistakes by drawing a line in the sand that was probably much harder than it needed to be and probably harder than a lot of Brexiteers would have felt they needed to be. You know, you can imagine a world in which if Leadsom or Boris Johnson or Penny Mordaunt or someone like that had won in 2016, they'd have been able to reach out to the 48% sincerely, and they would also have been able to sell to Brexiteers that something a bit softer was still Brexit. But because Theresa May wasn't a Brexiteer, she went off and struck a very hard line in the sand, and I think didn't really know what she was committing to a degree. And all that sort of knocks on. Where the second book ends was with the joint report deal, which created this famous backstop in Northern Ireland, which became the real kind of thing that was then a problem for the rest of the book and the rest of her premiership. But that looked at the time like it was just a sort of hurdle that she needed to clear. If she didn't clear it, you know, her premiership would be over. But actually, it was a sort of foundational sin, as you like, of the whole thing. That, and then a week later, the MPs get the right to a meaningful vote, and the whole of the rest of Theresa May's 18 months in power were defined by those two things. And she sort of pinned herself to a board like a butterfly and was unable to escape from it.
Well, to mix the metaphors a bit, if you have this vacuum, this black hole at the top, then what happens is that everyone else tries to sort of fill it from different sides. Yeah. And you talk almost as if people are people who started out immediately after the referendum. There were lots of Brexiteers who felt they wanted to be out for whatever reason, but wanted a close relationship with the EU. There were lots of Remainers who were happy to honour the outcome of the referendum and without, you know, with damage being limited. And this passage of time, this vacuum gets, it's sort of, people rushing into it end up being radicalised to take extreme positions one way or the other, which they just didn't have at the beginning of this process.
No, that's right. I mean, you know, people say, oh, maybe she should have reached out cross-party earlier than she did. I think that's difficult when it was Jeremy Corbyn on the other side of the fence who was not instinctively interested in the Brexit arrangements and had barely the support of his own MPs, even if he had. But certainly she was kind of this vacuum. And it's not, you know, there was no, you know, I mean, leadership, the clue is in the word, isn't it? You know, you stand up, you plant your flag, and people go with you. And actually, there were a lot of people, I think, who were willing to be led to a particular place. There was a theoretical majority in the House of Commons for a softer Brexit, you know, late 2017, early 2018. And the process of, you know, the first sort of third of this book is about everyone getting radicalised. And by the time you get to the spring of 2019, there were really only two choices. One is to sort of have a referendum and revoke the whole thing. And the other is to have a sort of no-deal Brexit. And people got more and more and more radicalised and entrenched. And it shows you what happens, I think, you know, big picture politics, if the person at the top provides no direction and is unable to persuade people to go where they want to go. And you see that with, you know, leaders we've got now. It's not always clear that, you know, Rishi Sunak, a bit like Theresa May, a bit like Gordon Brown, very good at the detail, very good at staring a problem. And Theresa May seemed to believe, as I think Rishi Sunak does, that if you stare at something for long enough, that, you know, the solution will present itself and everyone will then accept it. Neither of them terribly good at either doing that quickly or persuading other people the one they've come up with is the right one. And I think in both cases, and you see this a bit with Liz Truss in the memoir she's just written, this sort of view that policy and running things is terribly important, but this idea that sort of being good at the media or having some kind of communication strategy or selling it to the public is somehow this kind of, you know, sort of additional add-on that might be a bit sort of sordid and undesirable. And, you know, it's absolutely integral to doing politics. And what we're talking about here is how do you do politics well? And it's instructive. When I came to sort of write, it's nice fun to put lots of quotes in the book and, you know, each section has, you know, sort of apposite quotes for what kind of happens in it. I kept coming back to Otto von Bismarck and Lyndon Baines Johnson, who are arguably the best sort of politician of the 19th century and of the 20th century. Anyone who's read Robert Caro on LBJ knows that the guy was a sort of slightly malign genius, and I think the same goes for Bismarck. But Bismarck had this famous quote. I thought this is the sort of the key quote I want to put at the top of the book. You know, politics is the art of the possible. Everybody kind of knows that. I thought I'll look it up, see what the exact wording is, want to make sure I get it right. But it's a much more interesting quote than that because there's a second line, which nobody seems to know. It's politics is the art of the possible, the attainable, the art of the next best. And if Bismarck, who was famously blood and iron, you know, the uncompromising kind of chap, can see politics like that. It's about how do you get what you want to get? And that might mean accepting just a bit less than you were hoping for. And the story of Brexit, particularly during the parliamentary battles, is that Theresa May, the Brexiteers in the ERG group, and then the multiple sort of strands of what I call the resistance, which are people who wanted a referendum, people who wanted the customs union, people who wanted a Norway solution. All of those groups refused to accept second best. They wanted their solution. They weren't prepared to vote for anything else. And Gavin Barwell, who was Theresa May's chief of staff, said to me, you know, there were some Brexiteers, you know, who would do anything for Brexit apart from vote for it. And on the other side, we had two huge parliamentary jamborees where multiple options, most of them versions of soft Brexit, were offered to MPs, and they voted down every single one of them, as we know. And there's much more intrigue behind it than all of that, but that's the fundamental story. People didn't compromise on either side, and we ended up with this sort of impasse. And it took Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings to smash their way through it.
So how much of all that then, from when that happened, actually from 2016, Theresa May becomes Prime Minister, 2019, she stops becoming Prime Minister. How much of that just had to happen? Everyone had to get it out of their system. There had to be a period where everyone stamped their feet and lost their minds and demanded the best and wouldn't settle for the second best. And how much of it was something that Theresa May had agency over and could have either secured a deal earlier, got a better deal, resolved it? Would a different Prime Minister, if Boris Johnson had become Prime Minister in 2016, would that have been different? Or was it just an inevitability that the political establishment had to go potty for 3 years?
I mean, there are people who would conclude that. And there's, you know, I quote one of the Brexiteer MPs who's now a minister, who said to me, you know, maybe we just needed to do all this and to show that there was only one remaining solution. It's that line from Sherlock Holmes, isn't it? When, you know, you've ruled out all the other options, what remains must be the truth. But I think anyone who looks at this fairly really ought to conclude that, you know, a Brexiteer Prime Minister would have had a different time of it from Theresa May. And I think a more able Remainer Prime Minister would have made a different fist of it. Yes, to a degree, there was the whole British political class was learning about Brexit kind of on the job. And there's a slightly fatuous point someone makes in this book. You know, we'd never done this before. And it's a silly point, but it kind of, it's true. You know, when you do a budget or you go to war, there is a sort of established procedure that you go through to go about that. They'd never done Brexit before. They didn't really know what they were doing. And famously, David Cameron had told nobody to prepare for it. Now, there are people in Brussels, I quote one of them in the book, who says, you know, it is a politician's job to tell his officials not to prepare for these things, and it is the official's job to blooming well prepare for them. And Jeremy Haywood, who was then the cabinet secretary, didn't. Look, I mean, if Theresa May had worked out earlier what she was about, or had forced her cabinet to make a decision, she seemed to just want to keep everybody on board for a long time. And you can say, actually, Theresa May was extremely able at keeping the Conservative Party together for much longer than perhaps logically it ought to have been on this issue. But there was a lot of pain and a lot of misery that was caused by a lack of clarity and a lack of vision and a lack of leadership, it seems to me. You know, it was July of 2018. We're talking 2 years and a month after the referendum before we had the cabinet even had a policy on this issue. You know, and there was a meeting which I...
And the only thing that's really now remembered for is the fact that Boris Johnson and David Davis resigned over it.
Exactly. You know, that was supposedly the big moment. There had been a previous meeting at Chequers in February. That didn't really resolve anything. There was a ministerial meeting of all the Brexiteer ministers, which, you know, I go into in the book, in January of 2018, where they all decided that what they wanted was not to take the customs union sort of and single market solution, not start with Norway and work down, but start with a Canada trade deal and work up. And Theresa May took the exact opposite view. She ignored all her, you know, normally if every minister sits around in the key department and says, this is what we're going to do, the Prime Minister would listen to that, but she didn't. And then she pivots towards a sort of more customs union solution, but not calling it that, in the spring of 2018, and doesn't tell anybody. I mean, it's slightly sort of overdone by the Brexiteers. They didn't have a clue what was going on, because David Davis certainly did. And in the book, there are lots of letters that David Davis wrote to Theresa May saying, if you do this, this is what will happen. A lot of people mock David Davis. They say, you know, he sort of, there was a bit of performative macho kind of nonsense knocking about. You read these letters, they're remarkably prescient. They do predict pretty much what was going to happen, that the deal wouldn't get through and that the consequences be X, Y, and Z, both with Brussels councils and with the Conservative Party. This curious thing is that having written all these letters, David Davis then didn't act on them and resign and bring her down. He starts writing these in sort of towards the end of 2017. There's lots more of them in early 2018. He nearly, you know, arguably could have resigned over the joint report in December 2017. He could have resigned when he got wind of what Theresa May was up to, in some regards, in the sort of spring. There was a moment in June where he nearly did resign, and then he finally resigns in the July. But even then, he was still grateful for Theresa May bringing him back into frontline politics. And his argument now is, oh, well, I wanted to change the policy without changing the Prime Minister. I knew she'd go eventually, but and then we'd get to the right place. But you ask, was all this avoidable? It's hard to conclude that if they got rid of Theresa May straight after the 2017 election or after the joint report, or indeed in the spring of, in the summer of 2018 after Chequers, and she, you know, had everybody moved against her, she would have fallen.
Yeah.
Things would have been different. There's absolutely no question they could have been different. And most different of all, I think, would have been if Michael Gove had not pulled the trigger on Boris Johnson in 2016. You know, what all the members of the ERG recognise throughout this process, and this becomes very clear in sort of the autumn of 2018 when they're trying to sort of demand X, Y, and Z, they need Boris Johnson on board. And really, he's kind of half on board with what they want. He wants to become Prime Minister, he wants their support, but he doesn't want to nail himself completely to that sort of paleo-sceptic winner for the Conservative Party. He would have been a... If Boris Johnson turns around and said, this is Brexit, then most Brexiteers voters are going to accept that. And
which is basically what happened in the end.
That's what happened
in the
end. The
deal that he got wasn't a million miles away from Theresa May's, but it was Boris Johnson's deal.
Yeah, exactly. And look, in 2016, I'm sure there would have been chaos. I'm sure Boris Johnson and the civil service and everybody else would have had just as little clue about what Brexit really meant as happened under Theresa May. But he would have not had to pivot so hard towards... sort of hard Brexit at the start. He would have been able to bring Leave voters with him, and he would have been credibly able to reach out in that sort of London Mayor-style Boris Johnson to some of the Remainers. And it's hard to conclude that things might have looked very different. You might have had a much earlier row with Brussels, you know, if Johnson had taken the sort of hard-line-ish position he took in 2020, but it would have come to a head 3 years earlier. And I've spoken to plenty of people in Brussels who... would have preferred that. And actually, we tended to see Brussels as this sort of big amalgam. I think, you know, one of the interesting things that I don't think's really been written about before is that there were big differences between the Commission and the Council. The Council's the bit that looks after the member states. The Commission's the kind of permanent civil service. And in Britain, we have the view that the Commission was sort of a bit wicked and evil and unaccountable, and we'd always pushed against the Commission, and Jean-Claude Juncker was a terrible old drunk, and his sidekick Martin Selmayr was this you know, sort of Machiavellian character known as the monster of the Berlaymont. The story, really, the true story of what happened is that the Council actually thought a lot of what Theresa May was up to was a sort of halfway house that didn't work. The Commission bent over backwards to help her. And everyone focused on Michel Barnier and his expensive suits and his, you know, him looking slightly more dapper and on the ball than David Davis in a lot of those photo ops. David Davis's people once sawed off the legs of a chair so that Barnier was sitting lower down for one of them, which is one of the delicious little bits along the way. But the real story is that Theresa May's Brexit deal was not really done by Michel Barnier. It was done on the top of hotels and in secret meetings between Oliver Robbins and Martin Selmayr. And in the end, Juncker and Selmayr overruled Barnier and said, you know, give her what she wants, essentially. The problem was what she wanted didn't really work, either for half of the sort of member states in Brussels or for her own
or
party.
Or back home either.
Yeah.
So, again, in a minute, Tim, I want to ask you about, we've done the parallel universe of Boris Johnson taking over in 2016. What about the parallel universe where David Cameron doesn't go? Could he have done a better job? We'll do that next on Politics Out the Boring Bits.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Matt Chorley still speaking to Tim Shipman. One of the things that comes across in the book, and lots of quotes, there were how many people did he speak to? 250?
260, people. I think it is, yeah.
Lots on the record, many more off the record too. And lots of people at various points say, when complaining about Theresa May. Of course, the great thing about David Cameron was, you'd go in, he'd know this, and he'd do that, he'd take it on board, and he'd listen, and he'd da-da-da-da-da. Is there a parallel world where David Cameron doesn't quit in 2016... and would have done a better job than Theresa May coming in unelected?
I think if you can assume that David Cameron survives for 2 years, David Cameron's a much better politician than Theresa May and would have done a better job. I find it inconceivable that that wouldn't be the case. And in fact, if you look at after he returned to the cabinet, in the Sunak cabinet, ministers who attend that cabinet constantly tell me he's the class act in the room. He asks the right questions. He thinks about what we're trying to achieve, how we're trying to do it. You know, all the stuff, you know, we were talking about with the sort of theory of politics. I'm not one of those people who thinks that that what if is remotely credible. I don't think David Cameron could have stayed on. I think it would have been sort of absurd, and I don't think the public would have stomached it. And that's certainly the conclusion that Cameron and George Osborne came to. And more importantly, it's a conclusion they both still hold. A lot of people have gone back over their Brexit thoughts and thought, oh, actually, did I make a mistake there? Did I cock that up? That is not something they second guess. They kind of think it would have been ridiculous. And my assumption would be, to speculate a little, that had Cameron tried to stay on, I think the Tory MPs would have removed him certainly by Christmas, and I suspect within a month, to be honest. Because he wouldn't have done it with any conviction. And people, I think, felt that it needed someone who was, you know, he'd put himself up. It was the central policy of his government. He'd argued one way. Now, if you go back a little bit further, you can just about sustain the counterfactual that had he put up the referendum and let George Osborne run it, but he remained in a position of kind of neutrality like Harold Wilson did in 1975, then yes, he could have survived that. But having nailed his colours to the mast so vociferously, I don't think it was credible for him to stay. But if you allow that he did stay and that they don't get rid of him, then yeah, it would look different again. And he was a better salesman, and he ultimately, you know, he had better people around him as well, and that's quite important in all this.
But again, that's a big test of when people talk about the people around them, whether it's Boris Johnson making bad decisions or whatever. Like, that's still a mark of...
Of course it is.
..being the leader.
And Liz Truss, you know, in her new books, constantly going on, you know, you read that and it says, you know, I didn't have all the right political people around me, there weren't enough people in Downing Street, you know. I mean, she kicked off the people out of Downing Street the day she moved in, and if she didn't have good enough political staff, then, A, that was because she hadn't managed to put a team together properly, and B, it was because nobody wanted to go and work with her.
In your book, you say, throughout the Brexit years, the British government was held hostage by the personalities of the five prime ministers who did the job. The structures, organisation, goals and impulses shaped by, successively, a blasé public schoolboy, an indecisive introvert, a self-centred extrovert, an untravelled ideologue, and the school swat with little feel for politics. When you put it like that, some people say we haven't been best served by them. Who do you think of all of them was the best? Who does have the Shipman, ticks the Shipman theory for power, that you need to know where you want to go strategically, how to get there tactically, and have the necessary skills to execute their plans?
I mean, a lot of people won't want to hear this, but the only time, in my opinion, that politics has been done well between June 2016 and now is the second half of 2019, where Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings knew exactly what they were trying to do. Everybody in their Downing Street operation, all the civil servants, they all knew what the game was. Not everybody liked it. They pushed the limits of the constitution from one side, and they did so partly in response to the fact that the resistance had done so with John Bercow's assistance already, you know, in book three. The start of book four is obviously about that bit happening. And I think that's the one moment where you can say people had a goal, a means of achieving it, and went out and did it. And it was pretty ugly. But it was so entrenched and unpleasant by then that it was going to take something pretty remarkable to pull it through. And the story of Boris Johnson's premiership, of course, is that he didn't sustain it beyond 6 months. The two people who'd pulled that off then thought they were kings of the world and didn't have room for another king of the world.
And ultimately then they lost the where do you want to go?
They lost the where do you want to go, and obviously COVID kind of intervened and made that more difficult, but it's pretty clear that they were already having arguments by January of 2020. Cummings and Johnson were not remotely on the same page, and there's a chapter in the fourth book after the general election where they are beginning to fall out pretty dramatically even before COVID hits. COVID exacerbated that. And then once Dominic Cummings had gone, Johnson decided he wasn't prepared to have anybody with that amount of power again. He didn't want anyone to challenge his status as, you know, the king or the Führer and all these things he was going around calling himself. And you know, the story of the rest of his premiership is a drift and a lack of focus and putting in place two more teams of people, neither of whom was any better than the people working for Theresa May.
Last couple of thoughts. Keir Starmer, of course, key player in this whole period, shadow breaks, etc. Is there anything in the book that Team Starmer will be worried about the public being reminded of his role in all of this?
Well, look, I mean, I think it depends how you want to be seen. I think Starmer played a fairly canny game for his own sort of ability to move on and be the leader of the Labour Party. As Rishi Sunak is constantly reminding people on a weekly basis, Keir Starmer served Jeremy Corbyn in his shadow cabinet in a way that a lot of the people now working for Starmer didn't. And, you know, the Labour position became, we want to have a referendum. Starmer spent a fair bit of time manoeuvring Corbyn there, but certainly initially he wasn't pro that. So if you go through all the slightly different positions that Starmer adopted, I guess if you want to sort of say this is a guy who keeps cutting his cloth depending on the way that events evolve, that's a little bit instructive about who he is and how he might behave as Prime Minister. But from the sort of cynical viewpoint of the Shipman theory of power, Starmer's goal was to become leader of the Labour Party, and the way he went about that was to do enough to inveigle himself with the Corbynites to get the job. You know, there's a plenty of behind-the-scenes stuff where he's resisting things that he think are, you know, he throws his toys a couple of times when things are not going the direction he wants. Corbyn's lot try to bounce him in a couple of meetings, and he's clever enough to have had someone pre-leaking him what was about to happen, and he has a sort of performative hissy fit to stop it happening. Then he, you know, makes his intervention at the party conference in 2018 where he slightly oversteps the mark entirely on purpose to try and show the membership that he's on their side, and then gradually brings them to a position where, you know, he was seen as the guy cheerleading for a referendum, and that's what helped him become the leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
So there's a guy there with a goal and a clear sort of set of steps along the way. So he looks, you know, as we've seen since he became leader, you know, by fits and starts, but you know, he's had a relatively clear plan about what he wanted to do: detoxify the party, have a pop at the Tories, introduce himself to the nation, and, you know, he's more or less gone about that. So, you know, and this is a guy who speaks to people who are quite good at politics, you know, the sort of Alistair Campbells of this world who always talk about strategy. And you don't hear Tories talking about it in the same way, and they've just not kind of, you know, people who, you know, the Cameron Osborne years. Cameron was a good front man and Osborne was a pretty decent strategist. And it, as I say, apart from that period in 2019, it doesn't feel like we've had that from successive Conservative governments.
Ultimately, it's a strength to recognise your own weakness and have someone else in to come and plug it rather than trying to overcompensate.
Totally. And yeah. I think that's what a lot of people saw in Rishi Sunak when he took over. They thought, this guy looks like a grown-up, good administrator, but, you know, clearly he's not Boris Johnson at politics. So he'll kind of get people in to do that. And I think what surprised people is that Rishi Sunak's tried to run everything himself and make all the decisions on a strategic and a tactical level, and that hasn't gone terribly well.
So that is the story of No Way Out from 2017 to 2019.
With Boris Johnson walking through the door of Downing Street. So this book does have plenty of fun and games from the Tory leadership election in 2019 and what was going on, you know, in the Boris Johnson campaign, which was, you know, there were about nine different people he'd been asked to come up with his Brexit policy. There's all the great stuff about the spat in the flat with Carrie and what people like Linton Crosby were telling him to do about that. So there's plenty of Boris Johnson in this book.
He walks through the door.
He walks through the door.
That's the end of the story. Out picks up the last book. When can we expect that?
That's coming in June, and that begins with Johnson and Cummings in the foyer of Downing Street on the morning that he takes over. And, you know, the way Book 3 ends is effectively those two, through vote leave in the campaign, they made Brexit happen. Theresa May basically broke it. Now they own it. And the story of Book 4 is what they did about that.
Tim Shipman and No Way Out is available to buy from this week. And in fact, Tim wrote a long piece for the Sunday Times as well this week, which you can read online at thetimes.co.uk, sort of summing up some of the key moments from all of that. Tim will be back with PMQs unpacked as usual. But for now, from me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.